Cadman presents Tropic of Capricorn by Henry Miller, performed by Campbell Scott. Copyright 1961 by Grove Press, Inc. Production copyright 2009 by HarperCollins Publishers. Once you have given up the ghost, everything follows with dead certainty, even in the midst of chaos. From the beginning, it was never anything but chaos. It was a fluid which enveloped me, which I breathed in through the gills. In the substrata, where the moon shone steady and opaque, it was smooth and fecundating. Above it was a jangle and a discord. In everything I quickly saw the opposite, the contradiction, and between the real and the unreal, the irony, the paradox. I was my own worst enemy. There was nothing I wished to do which I could just as well not do. Even as a child, when I lacked for nothing, I wanted to die. I wanted to surrender because I saw no sense in struggling. I felt that nothing would be proved, substantiated, added or subtracted by continuing an existence which I had not asked for. Everybody around me was a failure, or if not a failure, ridiculous. Especially the successful ones. The successful ones bored me to tears. I was sympathetic to a fault, but it was not sympathy that made me so. It was a purely negative quality, a weakness which blossomed at the mere sight of human misery. I never helped anyone expecting that it would do any good. I helped because I was helpless to do otherwise. To want to change the condition of affairs seemed futile to me. Nothing would be altered, I was convinced, except by a change of heart, and who could change the hearts of men? Now and then, a friend was converted. It was something to make me puke. I had no more need of God than he had of me, and if there were one, I often said to myself, I would meet him calmly and spit in his face. What was most annoying was that at first blush, people usually took me to be good, to be kind, generous, loyal, faithful. Perhaps I did possess these virtues, but if so, it was because I was indifferent. I could afford to be good, kind, generous, loyal, and so forth, since I was free of envy. Envy was the one thing I was never a victim of. I have never envied anybody or anything. On the contrary, I have only felt pity for everybody and everything. From the very beginning, I must have trained myself not to want anything too badly. From the very beginning, I was independent, in a false way. I had need of nobody because I wanted to be free, free to do and to give only as my whims dictated. The moment anything was expected or demanded of me, I balked. That was the form my independence took. I was corrupt, in other words, corrupt from the start. It's as though my mother fed me a poison, and though I was weaned young, the poison never left my system. Even when she weaned me, it seemed that I was completely indifferent. Most children rebel, or make a pretense of rebelling, but I didn't give a damn. I was a philosopher when still in swaddling clothes. I was against life, on principle. What principle? The principle of futility. Everybody around me was struggling. I myself never made an effort. If I appeared to be making an effort, it was only to please someone else. At bottom, I didn't give a rap. And if you can tell me why this should have been so, I will deny it, because I was born with a cussed streak in me, and nothing can eliminate it. I heard later when I had grown up that they had a hell of a time bringing me out of the womb. I can understand that perfectly. Why budge? Why come out of a nice warm place, a cozy retreat in which everything is offered you gratis? The earliest remembrance I have is of the cold, the snow and ice in the gutter, the frost on the window panes, the chill of the sweaty green walls in the kitchen. Why do people live in outlandish climates, in the temperate zones, as they are miscalled? Because people are naturally idiots, naturally sluggards, naturally cowards. Until I was about 10 years old, I never realized that there were warm countries, places where you didn't have to sweat for a living, nor shiver and pretend that it was tonic and exhilarating. Wherever there is cold, there are people who work themselves to the bone, and when they produce young, they preach to the young the gospel of work, which is nothing, at bottom, but the doctrine of inertia. My people were entirely Nordic, which is to say, idiots. Every wrong idea which has ever been expounded was theirs. Among them was the doctrine of cleanliness, to say nothing of righteousness. They were painfully clean, but inwardly they stank. Never once had they opened the door which leads to the soul. Never once did they dream of taking a blind leap into the dark. After dinner, the dishes were promptly washed and put in the closet. After the paper was read, it was neatly folded and laid away on a shelf. After the clothes were washed, they were ironed and folded and then tucked away in the drawers. Everything was for tomorrow, but tomorrow never came. The present was only a bridge, and on this bridge they are still groaning as the world groans, and not one idiot ever thinks of blowing up the bridge. In my bitterness, I often search for reasons to condemn them, the better to condemn myself, for I am like them too, in many ways. For a long while I thought I had escaped, but as time goes on I see that I am no better, that I am even a little worse, because I saw more clearly than they ever did, and yet remained powerless to alter my life. As I look back on my life, it seems to me that I never did anything of my own volition, but always through the pressure of others. People often think of me as an adventurous fellow. Nothing could be farther from the truth. My adventures were always adventitious, always thrust on me, always endured rather than undertaken. I am of the very essence of that proud, boastful Nordic people who have never had the least sense of adventure, but who nevertheless have scoured the earth, turned it upside down, scattering relics and ruins everywhere. Restless spirits, but not adventurous ones. Agonizing spirits, incapable of living in the present. Disgraceful cowards, all of them, myself included. For there is only one great adventure, and that is inward toward the self, and for that time nor space nor even deeds matter. Once every few years I was on the verge of making this discovery, but in characteristic fashion I always managed to dodge the issue. If I try to think of a good excuse, I can think only of the environment, of the streets I knew and the people who inhabited them. I can think of no street in America, or of people inhabiting such a street, capable of leading one on toward the discovery of the self. I have walked the streets in many countries of the world, but nowhere have I felt so degraded and humiliated as in America. I think of all the streets in America combined as forming a huge cesspool, a cesspool of the spirit in which everything is sucked down and drained away to everlasting shit. Over this cesspool, the spirit of work weaves a magic wand. Palaces and factories spring up side by side, and munition plants, and chemical works, and steel mills, and sanatoriums, and prisons, and insane asylums. The whole continent is a nightmare, producing the greatest misery of the greatest number. I was one, a single entity in the midst of the greatest jamboree of wealth and happiness, statistical wealth, statistical happiness. But I never met a man who was truly wealthy or truly happy. At least I knew that I was unhappy, unwealthy, out of whack and out of step. That was my only solace, my only joy. But it was hardly enough. It would have been better for my peace of mind, for my soul, if I had expressed my rebellion openly, if I had gone to jail for it, if I had rotted there and died. It would have been better if, like the mad Czolgosz, I had shot some good President McKinley, some gentle, insignificant soul like that who had never done anyone the least harm. Because in the bottom of my heart there was murder. I wanted to see America destroyed, razed from top to bottom. I wanted to see this happen purely out of vengeance, as atonement for the crimes that were committed against me and against others like me who have never been able to lift their voices and express their hatred, their rebellion, their legitimate bloodlust. I was the evil product of an evil soil. If the self were not imperishable, the I write about would have been destroyed long ago. To some, this may seem like an invention, but whatever I imagined to have happened did actually happen, at least to me. History may deny it, since I have played no part in the history of my people, but even if everything I say is wrong, is prejudiced, spiteful, malevolent, even if I am a liar and a poisoner, it is nevertheless the truth, and it will have to be swallowed. As to what happened. Everything that happens, when it has significance, is in the nature of a contradiction. Until the one for whom this is written came along, I imagined that somewhere outside, in life, as they say, lay the solution to all things. I thought when I came upon her that I was seizing hold of life, seizing hold of something which I could bite into. Instead, I lost hold of life completely. I reached out for something to attach myself to, and I found nothing. But in reaching out, in the effort to grasp, to attach myself, left high and dry as I was, I nevertheless found something I had not looked for. Myself. I found that what I had desired all my life was not to live, if what others are doing is called living, but to express myself. I realized that I had never the least interest in living, but only in this which I am doing now, something which is parallel to life, of it at the same time, and beyond it. What is true interests me scarcely at all, nor even what is real. Only that interests me which I imagined to be, that which I had stifled every day in order to live. Whether I die today or tomorrow is of no importance to me, never has been. But that today even, after years of effort, I cannot say what I think and feel, that bothers me. That rankles. From childhood on, I can see myself on the track of this specter, enjoying nothing, desiring nothing but this power, this ability. Everything else is a lie. Everything I ever did or said which did not bear upon this. And that is pretty much the greater part of my life. I was a contradiction in essence, as they say. People took me to be serious and high-minded, or to be gay and reckless, or to be sincere and earnest, or to be negligent and carefree. I was all these things at once, and beyond that I was something else, something which no one suspected, least of all myself. As a boy of 6 or 7 I used to sit at my grandfather's workbench and read to him while he sewed. I remember him vividly in those moments when, pressing the hot iron against the seam of a coat, he would stand with one hand over the other and look out of the window dreamily. I remember the expression on his face as he stood there dreaming better than the contents of the books I read, better than the conversations we had or the games which I played in the street. I used to wonder what he was dreaming of, what it was that drew him out of himself. I hadn't learned yet how to dream wide awake. I was always lucid, in the moment, and all of a piece. His daydreaming fascinated me. I knew that he had no connection with what he was doing, not the least thought for any of us, that he was alone, and being alone, he was free. I was never alone, least of all when I was by myself. Always, it seems to me, I was accompanied. I was like a little crumb of a big cheese, which was the world, I suppose, though I never stopped to think about it. But I know I never existed separately, never thought myself the big cheese, as it were. So that even when I had reason to be miserable, to complain, to weep, I had the illusion of participating in a common, a universal misery. When I wept, the whole world was weeping, so I imagined. I wept very seldom. Mostly, I was happy. I was laughing. I was having a good time. I had a good time because, as I said before, I really didn't give a fuck about anything. If things were wrong with me, they were wrong everywhere. I was convinced of it. And things were wrong usually only when one cared too much. That impressed itself on me very early in life. For example, I remember the case of my young friend Jack Lawson. For a whole year he lay in bed, suffering the worst agonies. He was my best friend, so people said, at any rate. Well, at first I was probably sorry for him, and perhaps now and then I called at his house to inquire about him, but after a month or two had elapsed, I grew quite callous about his suffering. I said to myself he ought to die, and the sooner he dies, the better it will be, and having thought thus, I acted accordingly. That is to say, I promptly forgot about him, abandoned him to his fate. I was only about 12 years old at the time, and I remember being proud of my decision. I remember the funeral, too. What a disgraceful affair it was. There they were, friends and relatives all congregated about the bier and all of them bawling like sick monkeys. The mother especially gave me a pain in the ass. She was such a rare spiritual creature, a Christian Scientist, I believe, and though she didn't believe in disease and didn't believe in death either, she raised such a stink that Christ himself would have risen from the grave. But not her beloved Jack. No, Jack lay there cold as ice and rigid and unbeckonable. He was dead, and there were no two ways about it. I knew it, and I was glad of it. I didn't waste any tears over it. I couldn't say that he was better off, because after all, the he had vanished. He was gone, and with him the sufferings he had endured, and the suffering he had unwittingly inflicted on others. "Amen," I said to myself, and with that, being slightly hysterical, I let a loud fart, right beside the coffin. This caring too much, I remember that it only developed with me about the time I first fell in love, and even then I didn't care enough. If I had really cared, I wouldn't be here now writing about it. I'd have died of a broken heart, or I'd have swung for it. It was a bad experience because it taught me how to live a lie. It taught me to smile when I didn't want to smile, to work when I didn't believe in work, to live when I had no reason to go on living. Even when I had forgotten her, I still retained the trick of doing what I didn't believe in. It was all chaos from the beginning, as I have said, but sometimes I got so close to the center, to the very heart of the confusion, that it's a wonder things didn't explode around me. It is customary to blame everything on the war. I say the war had nothing to do with me, with my life. At a time when others were getting themselves comfortable berths, I was taking one miserable job after another, and never enough in it to keep body and soul together. Almost as quickly as I was hired, I was fired. I had plenty of intelligence, but I inspired distrust. Wherever I went, I fomented discord, not because I was idealistic, but because I was like a searchlight, exposing the stupidity and futility of everything. Besides, I wasn't a good ass-licker. That marked me, no doubt. People could tell at once when I asked for a job that I really didn't give a damn whether I got it or not, and of course I generally didn't get it. But after a time, the mere looking for a job became an activity, a pastime, so to speak. I would go in and ask for most anything. It was a way of killing time, no worse, as far as I could see, than work itself. I was my own boss, and I had my own hours, but unlike other bosses, I entrained only my own ruin, my own bankruptcy. I was not a corporation, or a trust, or a state, or a federation, or a polity of nations. I was more like God, if anything. This went on from about the middle of the war until, well, until one day I was trapped. Finally, the day came when I did desperately want a job. I needed it. Not having another minute to lose, I decided that I would take the last job on Earth, that of messenger boy. I walked into the employment bureau of the telegraph company, the Cosmo-Demonic Telegraph Company of North America, toward the close of the day, prepared to go through with it. I had just come from the public library, and I had under my arm some fat books on economics and metaphysics. To my great amazement, I was refused the job. The guy who turned me down was a little runt who ran the switchboard. He seemed to take me for a college student, though it was clear enough from my application that I had long left school. I had even honored myself on the application with a Ph.D. degree from Columbia University. Apparently that passed unnoticed, or else was suspiciously regarded by this runt who had turned me down. I was furious, the more so because, for once in my life, I was in earnest. Not only that, but I had swallowed my pride, which in certain peculiar ways is rather large. My wife, of course, gave me the usual leer and sneer. I had done it as a gesture, she said. I went to bed thinking about it, still smarting, getting angrier and angrier as the night wore on. The fact that I had a wife and child to support didn't bother me so much. People didn't offer you jobs because you had a family to support. That much I understood only too well. No. What rankled was that they had rejected me, Henry V. Miller, a competent, superior individual who had asked for the lowest job in the world. That burned me up. I couldn't get over it. In the morning I was up bright and early, shaved, put on my best clothes, and hot-footed it to the subway. I went immediately to the main offices of the telegraph company. Up to the 25th floor, or wherever it was that the president and the vice presidents had their cubicles, I asked to see the president. Of course, the president was either out of town or too busy to see me, but wouldn't I care to see the vice president, or his secretary, rather? I saw the vice president's secretary, an intelligent, considerate sort of chap, and I gave him an earful. I did it adroitly, without too much heat, but letting him understand all the while that I wasn't to be put out of the way so easily. When he picked up the telephone and demanded the general manager, I thought it was just a gag, that they were going to pass me around like that from one to the other until I'd get fed up. But the moment I heard him talk, I changed my opinion. When I got to the general manager's office, which was in another building uptown, they were waiting for me. I sat down in a comfortable leather chair and accepted one of the big cigars that were thrust forward. This individual seemed at once to be vitally concerned about the matter. He wanted me to tell him all about it, down to the last detail, his big hairy ears cocked to catch the least crumb of information which would justify something or other which was formulating itself inside his dome. I realized that by some accident I had really been instrumental in doing him a service. I let him wheedle it out of me to suit his fancy, observing all the time which way the wind was blowing. And as the talk progressed, I noticed that he was warming up to me more and more. At last, someone was showing a little confidence in me. That was all I required to get started on one of my favorite lines. For after years of job hunting, I had naturally become quite adept. I knew not only what not to say, but I knew also what to imply, what to insinuate. Soon the assistant general manager was called in and asked to listen to my story. By this time I knew what the story was. I understood that Jaime, that little kike, as the general manager called him, had no business pretending that he was the employment manager. Jaime had usurped his prerogative, that much was clear. It was also clear that Jaime was a Jew, and that Jews were not in good odor with the general manager, nor with Mr. Twilliger, the vice president, who was a thorn in the general manager's side. Perhaps it was Jaime, the dirty little kike, who was responsible for the high percentage of Jews on the messenger force. Perhaps Jaime was really the one who was doing the hiring at the employment office, at Sunset Place, they called it. It was an excellent opportunity, I gathered, for Mr. Clancy, the general manager, to take down a certain Mr. Burns, who, he informed me, had been the employment manager for some 30 years now, and who was evidently getting lazy on the job. The conference lasted several hours. Before it was terminated, Mr. Clancy took me aside and informed me that he was going to make me the boss of the works. Before putting me into office, however, he was going to ask me as a special favor, and also as a sort of apprenticeship, which would stand me in good stead, to work as a special messenger. I would receive the salary of employment manager, but it would be paid me out of a separate account. In short, I was to float from office to office and observe the way affairs were conducted by all and sundry. I was to make a little report from time to time as to how things were going, and once in a while, so he suggested, I was to visit him at his home on the QT and have a little chat about the conditions in the 101 branches of the Cosmo-Demonic Telegraph Company in New York City. In other words, I was to be a spy for a few months, and after that I was to have the run of the joint. Maybe they'd make me a general manager, too, one day, or a vice president. It was a tempting offer, even if it was wrapped up in a lot of horseshit. I said yes. In a few months I was sitting at Sunset Place, hiring and firing like a demon. It was a slaughterhouse, so help me God. The thing was senseless from the bottom up, a waste of men, material, and effort, a hideous farce against a backdrop of sweat and misery. But just as I had accepted the spying, so I accepted the hiring and firing and all that went with it. I said yes to everything. If the vice president decreed that no cripples were to be hired, I hired no cripples. If the vice president said that all messengers over 45 were to be fired without notice, I fired them without notice. I did everything they instructed me to do, but in such a way that they had to pay for it. When there was a strike, I folded my arms and waited for it to blow over. But I first saw to it that it cost them a good penny. The whole system was so rotten, so inhuman, so lousy, so hopelessly corrupt and complicated, that it would have taken a genius to put any sense or order into it, to say nothing of human kindness or consideration. I was up against the whole system of American labor, which is rotten at both ends. I was the fifth wheel on the wagon, and neither side had any use for me, except to exploit me. In fact, everybody was being exploited. The president and his gang by the unseen powers, the employees by the officials, and so on and around, in and out and through the whole works. From my little perch on Sunset Place, I had a bird's-eye view of the whole American society. It was like a page out of the telephone book. Alphabetically, numerically, statistically, it made sense. But when you looked at it up close, when you examined the pages separately, or the parts separately, when you examined one lone individual, and what constituted him, examined the air he breathed, the life he led, the chances he risked, you saw something so foul and degrading, so low, so miserable, so utterly hopeless and senseless, that it was worse than looking into a volcano. You could see the whole American life, economically, politically, morally, spiritually, artistically, statistically, pathologically. It looked like a grand canker on a worn-out cock. It looked worse than that, really, because you couldn't even see anything resembling a cock anymore. Maybe in the past, this thing had life, did produce something, did at least give a moment's pleasure, a moment's thrill. But looking at it from where I sat, it looked rottener than the wormiest cheese. The wonder was that the stench of it didn't carry him off. I'm using the past tense all the time, but of course it's the same now, maybe even a bit worse. At least now we're getting it full stink. By the time Valeska arrived on the scene, I had hired several army corps of messengers. My office at Sunset Place was like an open sewer, and it stank like one. I had dug myself into the first-line trench, and I was getting it from all directions at once. To begin with, the man I had ousted died of a broken heart a few weeks after my arrival. He held out just long enough to break me in, and then he croaked. Things happened so fast that I didn't have a chance to feel guilty. From the moment I arrived at the office, it was one long, uninterrupted pandemonium. An hour before my arrival, I was always late, the place was already jammed with applicants. I had to elbow my way up the stairs and literally force my way in to get to my desk. Before I could take my hat off, I had to answer a dozen telephone calls. There were 3 telephones on my desk, and they all rang at once. They were bawling the piss out of me before I had even sat down to work. There wasn't even time to take a crap, until 5 or 6 in the afternoon. Jaime was worse off than I because he was tied to the switchboard. He sat there from 8 in the morning until 6, moving waybills around. A waybill was a messenger loaned by one office to another office for the day or a part of the day. None of the 101 offices ever had a full staff. Jaime had to play chess with the waybills while I worked like a madman to plug up the gaps. If by a miracle I succeeded of a day in filling all the vacancies, the next morning would find the situation exactly the same, or worse. Perhaps 20% of the force was steady. The rest was driftwood. The steady ones drove the new ones away. The steady ones earned $40 to $50 a week, sometimes $60 or $75, sometimes as much as $100 a week. Which is to say that they earned far more than the clerks, and often more than their own managers. As for the new ones, they found it difficult to earn $10 a week. Some of them worked an hour and quit, often throwing a batch of telegrams in the garbage can or down the sewer. And whenever they quit, they wanted their pay immediately, which was impossible, because in the complicated bookkeeping which ruled, no one could say what a messenger had earned until at least 10 days later. In the beginning, I invited the applicant to sit down beside me, and I explained everything to him in detail. I did that until I lost my voice. Soon I learned to save my strength for the grilling that was necessary. In the first place, every other boy was a born liar, if not a crook to boot. Many of them had already been hired and fired a number of times. Some found it an excellent way to find another job, because their duty brought them to hundreds of offices which normally they would never have set foot in. Fortunately, McGovern, the old trustee who guarded the door and handed out the application blanks, had a camera eye. And then there were the big ledgers behind me, in which there was a record of every applicant who had ever passed through the mill. The ledgers were very much like a police record. They were full of red ink marks, signifying this or that delinquency. To judge from the evidence, I was in a tough spot. Every other name involved a theft, a fraud, a brawl, or dementia, or perversion, or idiocy. Be careful. So-and-so is an epileptic. Don't hire this man. He's a nigger. Watch out. X has been in Dannemora, or else in Sing Sing. If I had been a stickler for etiquette, nobody would have ever been hired. I had to learn quickly, and not from the records or from those about me, but from experience. There were 1,001 details by which to judge an applicant. I had to take them all in at once, and quickly. Because in one short day, even if you are as fast as Jack Robinson, you can only hire so many and no more. And no matter how many I hired, it was never enough. The next day it would begin all over again. Some I knew would last only a day, but I had to hire them just the same. The system was wrong from start to finish, but it was not my place to criticize the system. It was mine to hire and fire. I was in the center of a revolving disk, which was whirling so fast that nothing could stay put. What was needed was a mechanic, but according to the logic of the higher-ups, there was nothing wrong with the mechanism. Everything was fine and dandy, except that things were temporarily out of order. And things being temporarily out of order brought on epilepsy, theft, vandalism, perversion, niggers, Jews, whores, and whatnot, sometimes strikes and lockouts. Whereupon, according to this logic, you took a big broom and you swept the stable clean, or you took clubs and guns and you beat sense into the poor idiots who were suffering from the illusion that things were fundamentally wrong. It was good now and then to talk of God, or to have a little community sing. Maybe even a bonus was justifiable now and then, that is, when things were getting too terribly bad for words. But on the whole, the important thing was to keep hiring and firing. As long as there were men and ammunition, we were to advance, to keep mopping up the trenches. Meanwhile, Jaime kept taking cathartic pills, enough to blow out his rear end if he had a rear end, but he hadn't one anymore. He only imagined he was taking a crap. He only imagined he was shitting on his can. Actually, the poor bugger was in a trance. There were 101 offices to look after, and each one had a staff of messengers which was mythical, if not hypothetical, and whether the messengers were real or unreal, tangible or intangible, Jaime had to shuffle them about from morning to night, while I plugged up the holes, which was also imaginary, because who could say when a recruit had been dispatched to an office whether he would arrive there today, or tomorrow, or never? Some of them got lost in the subway, or in the labyrinths under the skyscrapers. Some rode around on the elevated line all day, because with a uniform it was a free ride, and perhaps they had never enjoyed riding around all day on the elevated lines. Some of them started for Staten Island and ended up in Canarsie, or else were brought back in a coma by a cop. Some forgot where they lived and disappeared completely. Some whom we hired for New York turned up in Philadelphia a month later, as though it were normal and according to Hoyle. Some would start for their destination and on the way decide that it was easier to sell newspapers, and they would sell them in the uniform we had given them until they were picked up. Some went straight to the observation ward, moved by some strange preservative instinct. When he arrived in the morning, Jaime first sharpened his pencils. He did this religiously, no matter how many calls were coming in, because, as he explained to me later, if he didn't sharpen the pencils first thing off the bat, they would never get sharpened. The next thing was to take a glance out the window and see what the weather was like. Then, with a freshly sharpened pencil, he made a little box at the head of the slate which he kept beside him, and in it he gave the weather report. This, he also informed me, often turned out to be a useful alibi. If the snow were a foot thick, or the ground covered with sleet, even the devil himself might be excused for not shuffling the waybills around more speedily, and the employment manager might also be excused for not filling up the holes on such days, no? But why he didn't take a crap first instead of plugging in on the switchboard soon as his pencils were sharpened was a mystery to me. That, too, he explained to me later. Anyway, the day always broke with confusion, complaints, constipation, and vacancies. It also began with loud, smelly farts, with bad breaths, with ragged nerves, with epilepsy, with meningitis, with low wages, with back pay that was overdue, with worn-out shoes, with corns and bunions, with flat feet and broken arches, with pocketbooks missing and fountain pens lost or stolen, with telegrams floating in the sewer, with threats from the vice president and advice from the managers, with wrangles and disputes, with cloudbursts and broken telegraph wires, with new methods of efficiency and old ones that had been discarded, with hope for better times and a prayer for the bonus which never came. The new messengers were going over the top and getting machine-gunned. The old ones were digging in deeper and deeper, like rats in a cheese. Nobody was satisfied, especially not the public. It took 10 minutes to reach San Francisco over the wire, but it might take a year to get the message to the man whom it was intended for, or it might never reach him. The YMCA, eager to improve the morale of working boys everywhere in America, was holding meetings at noon hour, and wouldn't I like to send a few spruce-looking boys to hear William Carnegie Astorbilt Jr. give a 5-minute talk on service. Mr. Mallory of the Welfare League would like to know if I could spare a few minutes sometime to tell me about the model prisoners who are on parole and who would be glad to serve in any capacity, even as messengers. Mrs. Guggenhofer of the Jewish Charities would be very grateful if I would aid her in maintaining some broken-down homes which had broken down because everybody was either infirm, crippled, or disabled in the family. Mr. Haggerty of the Runaway Home for Boys was sure he had just the right youngsters for me, if only I would give them a chance. All of them had been mistreated by their stepfathers or stepmothers. The mayor of New York would appreciate it if I would give my personal attention to the bearer of said letter, whom he could vouch for in every way. But why the hell he didn't give said bearer a job himself was a mystery. Man leaning over my shoulder hands me a slip of paper on which he has just written, "Me understand everything, but me no hear the voices." Luther Winifred is standing beside him, his tattered coat fastened together with safety pins. Luther is 2/7 pure Indian and 5/7 German-American, so he explains. On the Indian side, he is a Crow, one of the Crows from Montana. His last job was putting up window shades, but there is no ass in his pants, and he is ashamed to climb a ladder in front of a lady. He got out of the hospital the other day, and so he is still a little weak, but he is not too weak to carry messages, so he thinks. And then there is Ferdinand Misch. How could I have forgotten him? He has been waiting in line all morning to get a word with me. I never answered the letters he sent me. Was that just? He asks me blandly. Of course not. I remember vaguely the last letter which he sent me from the Cat and Dog Hospital on the Grand Concourse, where he was an attendant. He said he repented that he had resigned his post, but it was on account of his father being too strict over him, not giving him any recreation or outside pleasure. "I'm 25 now," he wrote, "and I don't think I should ought to be sleeping no more with my father, do you? I know you are said to be a very fine gentleman, and I am now self-dependent, so I hope." McGovern, the old trustee, is standing by Ferdinand's side, waiting for me to give him the sign. He wants to give Ferdinand the bum's rush. He remembers him from 5 years ago, when Ferdinand lay down on the sidewalk in front of the main office in full uniform and threw an epileptic fit. No, shit, I can't do it. I'm going to give him a chance, the poor bastard. Maybe I'll send him to Chinatown, where things are fairly quiet. Meanwhile, while Ferdinand is changing into a uniform in the back room, I'm getting an earful from an orphan boy who wants to help make the company a success. He says that if I give him a chance, he'll pray for me every Sunday when he goes to church, except the Sundays when he has to report to his parole officer. He didn't do nothing, it appears. He just pushed the fellow, and the fellow fell on his head and got killed. Next, an ex-consul from Gibraltar. Writes a beautiful hand. Too beautiful. I ask him to see me at the end of the day. Something fishy about him. Meanwhile, Ferdinand's thrown a fit in the dressing room. Lucky break. If it had happened in the subway with a number on his hat and everything, I'd have been canned. Next, a guy with one arm and mad as hell because McGovern is showing him the door. What the hell? I'm strong and healthy, ain't I? He shouts, and to prove it, he picks up a chair with his good arm and smashes it to bits. I get back to the desk, and there's a telegram lying there for me. I open it. It's from George Blazini, ex-messenger number 2459 of Southwest Office. I am sorry that I had to quit so soon, but the job was not fitted for my character idleness, and I am a true lover of labor and frugality, but many a time we be unable to control or subdue our personal pride. Shit. In the beginning, I was enthusiastic, despite the damper above and the clamps below. I had ideas, and I executed them, whether it pleased the vice president or not. Every 10 days or so, I was put on the carpet and lectured for having too big a heart. I never had any money in my pocket, but I used other people's money freely. As long as I was the boss, I had credit. I gave money away right and left. I gave my clothes away, and my linen, my books, everything that was superfluous. If I had had the power, I would have given the company away to the poor buggers who pestered me. If I was asked for a dime, I gave a half dollar. If I was asked for a dollar, I gave 5. I didn't give a fuck how much I gave away. because it was easier to borrow and give than to refuse the poor devils. I never saw such an aggregation of misery in my life, and I hope I'll never see it again. Men are poor everywhere. They always have been, and they always will be. And beneath the terrible poverty there is a flame, usually so low that it is almost invisible. But it is there, and if one has the courage to blow on it, it can become a conflagration. I was constantly urged not to be too lenient, not to be too sentimental, not to be too charitable. Be firm, be hard, they cautioned me. Fuck that, I said to myself. I'll be generous, pliant, forgiving, tolerant, tender. In the beginning, I heard every man to the end. If I couldn't give him a job, I gave him money. And if I had no money, I gave him cigarettes, or I gave him courage. But I gave. The effect was dizzying. Nobody can estimate the results of a good deed, of a kind word. I was swamped with gratitude, with good wishes, with invitations, with pathetic, tender little gifts. If I had had real power instead of being the fifth wheel on a wagon, God knows what I might not have accomplished. I could have used the Cosmo-Demonic Telegraph Company of North America as a base to bring all humanity to God. I could have transformed North and South America alike, and the Dominion of Canada, too. I had the secret in my hand. It was to be generous, to be kind, to be patient. I did the work of five men. I hardly slept for 3 years. I didn't own a whole shirt, and often I was so ashamed of borrowing from my wife or robbing the kids' bank that to get the car fare to go to work in the morning I would swindle the blind newspaper man at the subway station. I owed so much money all around that if I were to work for 20 years I would not have been able to pay it back. I took from those who had, and I gave to those who needed, and it was the right thing to do, and I would do it all over again if I were in the same position. I even accomplished the miracle of stopping the crazy turnover, something that nobody had dared to hope for. Instead of supporting my efforts, they undermined me. According to the logic of the higher-ups, the turnover had ceased because the wages were too high, so they cut the wages. It was like kicking the bottom out of a bucket. The whole edifice tumbled, collapsed on my hands. And just as though nothing had happened, they insisted that the gaps be plugged up immediately. To soften the blow a bit, they intimated that I might even increase the percentage of Jews. I might take on a cripple now and then, if he were capable. I might do this and that, all of which they had informed me previously was against the code. I was so furious that I took on anything and everything. I would have taken on broncos and gorillas if I could have imbued them with the modicum of intelligence which was necessary to deliver messages. A few days previously there had been only 5 or 6 vacancies at closing time. Now there were 300, 400, 500. They were running out like sand. It was marvelous. I sat there, and without asking a question, I took them on in carload lots. Niggers, Jews, paralytics, cripples, ex-convicts, whores, maniacs, perverts, idiots, any fucking bastard who could stand on 2 legs and hold a telegram in his hand. The managers of the 101 offices were frightened to death. I laughed. I laughed all day long, thinking what a fine, stinking mess I was making of it. Complaints were pouring in from all parts of the city. The service was crippled, constipated, strangulated. A mule could have gotten there faster than some of the idiots I put into harness. The best thing about the new day was the introduction of female messengers. It changed the whole atmosphere of the joint. For Jaime especially, it was a godsend. He moved his switchboard around so that he could watch me while juggling the waybills back and forth. Despite the added work, he had a permanent erection. He came to work with a smile, and he smiled all day long. He was in heaven. At the end of the day, I always had a list of 5 or 6 who were worth trying out. The game was to keep them on the string, to promise them a job, but to get a free fuck first. Usually it was only necessary to throw a feed into them in order to bring them back to the office at night and lay them out on the zinc-covered table in the dressing room. If they had a cozy apartment, as they sometimes did, we took them home and finished it in bed. If they liked to drink, Jaime would bring a bottle along. If they were any good and really needed some dough, Jaime would flash his roll and peel off a 5-spot or a 10-spot, as the case might be. It makes my mouth water when I think of that roll he carried about with him. Where he got it from I never knew, because he was the lowest paid man in the joint, but it was always there, and no matter what I asked for, I got. And once it happened that we did get a bonus, and I paid Jaime back to the last penny, which so amazed him that he took me out that night to Delmonico's and spent a fortune on me. Not only that, but the next day he insisted on buying me a hat and shirts and gloves. He even insinuated that I might come home and fuck his wife if I liked, though he warned me that she was having a little trouble at present with her ovaries. In addition to Jaime and McGovern, I had as assistants a pair of beautiful blondes who often accompanied us to dinner in the evening. And there was O'Mara, an old friend of mine who had just returned from the Philippines and whom I made my chief assistant. There was also Steve Romero, a prize bull whom I kept around in case of trouble, and O'Rourke, the company detective, who reported to me at the close of day when he began his work. Finally, I added another man to the staff, Kronsky, a young medical student who was diabolically interested in the pathological cases of which we had plenty. We were a merry crew, united in our desire to fuck the company at all costs, and while fucking the company, we fucked everything in sight that we could get hold of, O'Rourke excepted, as he had a certain dignity to maintain. And besides, he had trouble with his prostate, and had lost all interest in fucking. But O'Rourke was a prince of a man, and generous beyond words. It was O'Rourke who often invited us to dinner in the evening, and it was O'Rourke we went to when we were in trouble. That was how it stood at Sunset Place after a couple of years had rolled by. I was saturated with humanity, with experiences of one kind and another. In my sober moments, I made notes which I intended to make use of later, if ever I should have a chance to record my experiences. I was waiting for a breathing spell. And then by chance, one day, when I had been put on the carpet for some wanton piece of negligence, the vice president let drop a phrase which stuck in my crop. He had said that he would like to see someone write a sort of Horatio Alger book about the messengers. He hinted that perhaps I might be the one to do such a job. I was furious to think what a ninny he was, and delighted at the same time, because secretly I was itching to get the thing off my chest. I thought to myself, "You poor old futzer, you. Just wait until I get it off my chest. I'll give you an Horatio Alger book. Just you wait." My head was in a whirl leaving his office. I saw the army of men, women, and children that had passed through my hands, saw them weeping, begging, beseeching, imploring, cursing, spitting, fuming, threatening. I saw the tracks they left on the highways, the freight trains lying on the floor, the parents in rags, the coal box empty, the sink running over, the walls sweating, and between the cold beads of sweat, the cockroaches running like mad. I saw them hobbling along like twisted gnomes or falling backwards in the epileptic frenzy, the mouth twitching, the slaver pouring from the lips, the limbs writhing. I saw the walls giving way, and the pest pouring out like a winged fluid, and the men higher up with their ironclad logic, waiting for it to blow over, waiting for everything to be patched up, waiting contentedly, smugly, with big cigars in their mouths and their feet on the desk, saying things were temporarily out of order. I saw the Horatio Alger hero, the dream of a sick America, mounting higher and higher, first messenger, then operator, then manager, then chief, then superintendent, then vice president, then trust magnate, then beer baron, then lord of all the Americas, the money god of gods, the clay of clay, nullity on high, zero with 97,000 decimals fore and aft. "You shits," I said to myself. "I will give you the picture of 12 little men, zeros without decimals, ciphers, digits, the 12 uncrushable worms who are hollowing out the base of your rotten edifice. I will give you Horatio Alger as he looks the day after the apocalypse, when all the stink has cleared away." From all over the earth they had come to me to be succored. Except for the primitives, there was scarcely a race which wasn't represented on the force. Except for the Ainus, the Maoris, the Papuans, the Vedas, the Laps, the Zulus, the Patagonians, the Igorotes, the Hottentots, the Tuaregs, except for the lost Tasmanians, the lost Grimaldi men, the lost Atlanteans, I had a representative of almost every species under the sun. I had two brothers who were still sun worshippers. Two Nestorians from the old Assyrian world, I had two Maltese twins from Malta, and a descendant of the Mayas from Yucatan. I had a few of our little brown brothers from the Philippines, and some Ethiopians from Abyssinia. I had men from the Pampas of Argentina and stranded cowboys from Montana. I had Greeks, Letts, Poles, Croats, Slovenes, Ruthenians, Czechs, Spaniards, Welshmen, Finns, Swedes, Russians, Danes, Mexicans, Puerto Ricans, Cubans, Uruguayans, Brazilians, Australians, Persians, Japs, Chinese, Javanese, Egyptians, Africans from the Gold Coast and the Ivory Coast, Hindus, Armenians, Turks, Arabs, Germans, Irish, English, Canadians, and plenty of Italians, and plenty of Jews. I had only one Frenchman that I can recall, and he lasted about 3 hours. I had a few American Indians, Cherokees mostly, but no Tibetans and no Eskimos. I saw names I could never have imagined, and handwriting which ranged from cuneiform to the sophisticated and astoundingly beautiful calligraphy of the Chinese. I heard men beg for work who had been Egyptologists, botanists, surgeons, gold miners, professors of Oriental languages, musicians, engineers, physicians, astronomers, anthropologists, chemists, mathematicians, mayors of cities and governors of states, prison wardens, cow punchers, lumberjacks, sailors, oyster pirates, stevedores, riveters, dentists, painters, sculptors, plumbers, architects, dope peddlers, abortionists, white slavers, sea divers, steeplejacks, farmers, cloak and suit salesmen, trappers, lighthouse keepers, pimps, aldermen, senators, every bloody thing under the sun, and all of them down and out, begging for work, for cigarettes, for car fare, for a chance, Christ Almighty, just another chance. I saw and got to know men who were saints, if there are saints in this world. I saw and spoke to savants, crapulous and uncrapulous ones. I listened to men who had the divine fire in their bowels, who could have convinced God Almighty that they were worthy of another chance, but not the vice president of the Cosmococcyx Telegraph Company. I sat riveted to my desk, and I traveled around the world at lightning speed, and I learned that everywhere it is the same. Hunger, humiliation, ignorance, vice, greed, extortion, chicanery, torture, despotism, the inhumanity of man to man, the fetters, the harness, the halter, the bridle, the whip, the spurs. The finer the caliber, the worse off the man. Men were walking the streets of New York in that bloody, degrading outfit, the despised, the lowest of the low, walking around like auks, like penguins, like oxen, like trained seals, like patient donkeys, like big jackasses, like crazy gorillas, like docile maniacs nibbling at the dangling bait, like waltzing mice, like guinea pigs, like squirrels, like rabbits, and many a one was fit to govern the world, to write the greatest book ever written. When I think of some of the Persians, the Hindus, the Arabs I knew, when I think of the character they revealed, their grace, their tenderness, their intelligence, their holiness, I spit on the white conquerors of the world, the degenerate British, the pig-headed Germans, the smug, self-satisfied French. The earth is one great sentient being, a planet saturated through and through with man, a live planet expressing itself falteringly and stutteringly. It is not the home of the white race or the black race or the yellow race or the lost blue race, but the home of man, and all men are equal before God and will have their chance, if not now, then a million years hence. The little brown brothers of the Philippines may bloom again one day, and the murdered Indians of America, north and south, may also come alive one day to ride the plains where now the cities stand belching fire and pestilence. Who has the last say? Man. The earth is his because he is the earth, its fire, its water, its air, its mineral and vegetable matter, its spirit, which is cosmic, which is imperishable, which is the spirit of all the planets, which transforms itself through him, through endless signs and symbols, through endless manifestations. Wait, you cosmococcyx telegraphic shits, you demons on high waiting for the plumbing to be repaired. Wait, you dirty white conquerors who have sullied the earth with your cloven hoofs, your instruments, your weapons, your disease germs, wait, all you who are sitting in clover and counting your coppers, it is not the end. The last man will have his say before it is finished. Down to the last sentient molecule, justice must be done, and will be done. Nobody is getting away with anything. least of all the cosmocoxic shits of North America. When it came time for my vacation, I hadn't taken one for 3 years. I was so eager to make the company a success. I took 3 weeks instead of two, and I wrote the book about the 12 little men. I wrote it straight off, 5, 7, sometimes 8,000 words a day. I thought that a man to be a writer must do at least 5,000 words a day. I thought he must say everything all at once, in one book, and collapse afterwards. I didn't know a thing about writing. I was scared shitless. But I was determined to wipe Horatio Alger out of the North American consciousness. I suppose it was the worst book any man has ever written. It was a colossal tome, and faulty from start to finish. But it was my first book, and I was in love with it. If I had had the money, as Gide had, I would have published it at my own expense. If I had had the courage that Whitman had, I would have peddled it from door to door. Everybody I showed it to said it was terrible. I was urged to give up the idea of writing. I had to learn, as Balzac did, that one must write volumes before signing one's own name. I had to learn, as I soon did, that one must give up everything and not do anything else but write, that one must write and write and write, even if everybody in the world advises you against it, even if nobody believes in you. Perhaps one does it just because nobody believes. Perhaps the real secret lies in making people believe. That the book was inadequate, faulty, bad, terrible, as they said, was only natural. I was attempting at the start what a man of genius would have undertaken only at the end. I wanted to say the last word at the beginning. It was absurd and pathetic. It was a crushing defeat, but it put iron in my backbone and sulfur in my blood. I knew at least what it was to fail. I knew what it was to attempt something big. Today, when I think of the circumstances under which I wrote that book, when I think of the overwhelming material which I tried to put into form, when I think of what I hope to encompass, I pat myself on the back. I give myself a double A. I am proud of the fact that I made such a miserable failure of it. Had I succeeded, I would have been a monster. Sometimes, when I look over my notebooks, when I look at the names alone of those whom I thought to write about, I am seized with vertigo. Each man came to me with a world of his own. He came to me and unloaded it on my desk. He expected me to pick it up and put it on my shoulders. I had no time to make a world of my own. I had to stay fixed, like Atlas, my feet on the elephant's back and the elephant on the tortoise's back. To inquire on what the tortoise stood would be to go mad. I didn't dare to think of anything then except the facts. To get beneath the facts, I would have had to be an artist, and one doesn't become an artist overnight. First, you have to be crushed, to have your conflicting points of view annihilated. You have to be wiped out as a human being in order to be born again an individual. You have to be carbonized and mineralized in order to work upwards from the last common denominator of the self. You have to get beyond pity in order to feel from the very roots of your being. One can't make a new heaven and earth with facts. There are no facts. There is only the fact that man, everywhere in the world, is on his way to ordination. Some men take the long route, and some take the short route. Every man is working out his destiny in his own way, and nobody can be of help except by being kind, generous, and patient. In my enthusiasm, certain things were then inexplicable to me which now are clear. I think, for example, of Carnahan, one of the 12 little men I had chosen to write about. He was what is called a model messenger. He was a graduate of a prominent university, had a sound intelligence, and was of exemplary character. He worked 18 and 20 hours a day, and earned more than any messenger on the force. The clients whom he served wrote letters about him, praising him to the skies. He was offered good positions, which he refused for one reason or another. He lived frugally, sending the best part of his wages to his wife and children who lived in another city. He had two vices, drink and the desire to succeed. He could go for a year without drinking, but if he took one drop, he was off. He had cleaned up twice in Wall Street, and yet, before coming to me for a job, he had gotten no further than to be a sexton of a church in some little town. He had been fired from that job because he had broken into the sacramental wine and rung the bells all night long. He was truthful, sincere, earnest. I had implicit confidence in him, and my confidence was proven by the record of his service, which was without a blemish. Nevertheless, he shot his wife and children in cold blood, and then he shot himself. Fortunately, none of them died. They all lay in the hospital together, and they all recovered. I went to see his wife after they had transferred him to jail to get her help. She refused categorically. She said he was the meanest, cruelest son of a bitch that ever walked on two legs. She wanted to see him hanged. I pleaded with her for 2 days, but she was adamant. I went to the jail and talked to him through the mesh. I found that he had already made himself popular with the authorities, had already been granted special privileges. He wasn't at all dejected. On the contrary, he was looking forward to making the best of his time in prison by studying up on salesmanship. He was going to be the best salesman in America after his release. I might almost say that he seemed happy. He said not to worry about him. He would get along all right. He said everybody was swell to him and that he had nothing to complain about. I left him somewhat in a daze. I went to a nearby beach and decided to take a swim. I saw everything with new eyes. I almost forgot to return home, so absorbed had I become in my speculations about this chap. Who could say that everything that happened to him had not happened for the best? Perhaps he might leave the prison a full-fledged evangelist instead of a salesman. Nobody could predict what he might do, and nobody could aid him because he was working out his destiny in his own private way. There was another chap, a Hindu named Guptal. He was not only a model of good behavior, he was a saint. He had a passion for the flute, which he played all by himself in his miserable little room. One day he was found naked, his throat slit from ear to ear, and beside him on the bed was his flute. At the funeral there were a dozen women who wept passionate tears, including the wife of the janitor who had murdered him. I could write a book about this young man, who was the gentlest and the holiest man I ever met, who had never offended anybody and never taken anything from anybody, but who had made the cardinal mistake of coming to America to spread peace and love. There was Dave Olinsky, another faithful, industrious messenger who thought of nothing but work. He had one fatal weakness. He talked too much. When he came to me, he had already been around the globe several times, and what he hadn't done to make a living isn't worth telling about. He knew about 12 languages, and he was rather proud of his linguistic ability. He was one of those men whose very willingness and enthusiasm is their undoing. He wanted to help everybody along, show everybody how to succeed. He wanted more work than we could give him. He was a glutton for work. Perhaps I should have warned him when I sent him to his office on the east side that he was going to work in a tough neighborhood, but he pretended to know so much and he was so insistent on working in that locality because of his linguistic ability that I said nothing. I thought to myself, you'll find out quickly enough for yourself. And sure enough, he was only there a short time when he got into trouble. A tough Jew boy from the neighborhood walked in one day and asked for a blank. Dave, the messenger, was behind the desk. He didn't like the way the man asked for the blank. He told him he ought to be more polite. For that, he got a box in the ears. That made him wag his tongue some more, whereupon he got such a wallop that his teeth flew down his throat and his jawbone was broken in 3 places. Still, he didn't know enough to hold his trap. Like the damned fool that he was, he goes to the police station and registers a complaint. A week later, while he's sitting on a bench snoozing, a gang of roughnecks break into the place and beat him to a pulp. His head was so battered that his brains looked like an omelet. For good measure, they emptied the safe and turned it upside down. Dave died on the way to the hospital. They found $500 hidden away in the toe of his sock. Then there was Clausen and his wife Lena. They came in together when he applied for the job. Lena had a baby in her arms, and he had 2 little ones by the hand. They were sent to me by some relief agency. I put him on as a night messenger, so that he'd have a fixed salary. In a few days I had a letter from him, a batty letter, in which he asked me to excuse him for being absent, as he had to report to his parole officer. Then another letter saying that his wife had refused to sleep with him, because she didn't want any more babies, and would I please come to see them, and try to persuade her to sleep with him. I went to his home, a cellar in the Italian quarter. It looked like a bug house. Lena was pregnant again, about 7 months underway, and on the verge of idiocy. She had taken to sleeping on the roof because it was too hot in the cellar, also because she didn't want him to touch her anymore. When I said it wouldn't make any difference now, she just looked at me and grinned. Clausen had been in the war, and maybe the gas had made him a bit goofy. At any rate, he was foaming at the mouth. He said he would brain her if she didn't stay off that roof. He insinuated that she was sleeping up there in order to carry on with the coal man who lived in the attic. At this, Lena smiled again with that mirthless Batrachian grin. Clausen lost his temper and gave her a swift kick in the ass. She went out in a huff, taking the brats with her. He told her to stay out for good. Then he opened a drawer and pulled out a big Colt. He was keeping it in case he needed it sometime, he said. He showed me a few knives, too, and a sort of blackjack which he had made himself. Then he began to weep. He said his wife was making a fool of him. He said he was sick of working for her because she was sleeping with everybody in the neighborhood. The kids weren't his because he couldn't make a kid anymore, even if he wanted to. The very next day, while Lena was out marketing, he took the kids up to the roof, and with the blackjack he had shown me, he beat their brains out. Then he jumped off the roof, head first. When Lena came home and saw what happened, she went off her nut. They had to put her in her straitjacket and call for the ambulance. There was Schuldig, the rat who had spent 20 years in prison for a crime he had never committed. He had been beaten almost to death before he confessed. Then solitary confinement, starvation, torture, perversion, dope. When they finally released him, he was no longer a human being. He described to me one night his last 30 days in jail, the agony of waiting to be released. I have never heard anything like it. I didn't think a human being could survive such anguish. Freed, he was haunted by the fear that he might be obliged to commit a crime and be sent back to prison again. He complained of being followed, spied on, perpetually tracked. He said they were tempting him to do things he had no desire to do. They were the dicks who were on his trail, who were paid to bring him back again. At night when he was asleep, they whispered in his ear. He was powerless against them because they mesmerized him first. Sometimes they placed dope under his pillow, and with it a revolver or a knife. They wanted him to kill some innocent person so that they would have a solid case against him this time. He got worse and worse. One night, after he had walked around for hours with a batch of telegrams in his pocket, he went up to a cop and asked to be locked up. He couldn't remember his name or address or even the office he was working for. He had completely lost his identity. He repeated over and over, "I'm innocent. I'm innocent." Again they gave him the third degree. Suddenly he jumped up and shouted like a madman, "I'll confess! I'll confess!" And with that he began to reel off one crime after another. He kept it up for 3 hours. Suddenly, in the midst of a harrowing confession, he stopped short, gave a quick look about like a man who has suddenly come to, and then with the rapidity and the force which only a madman can summon, he made a tremendous leap across the room and crashed his skull against the stone wall. I relate these incidents briefly and hurriedly as they flash through my mind. My memory is packed with thousands of such details, with a myriad of faces, gestures, tales, confessions, all entwined and interlaced, like the stupendous reeling facade of some Hindu temple made not of stone, but of the experience of human flesh. A monstrous dream edifice built entirely of reality, and yet not reality itself, but merely the vessel in which the mystery of the human being is contained. My mind wanders to the clinic where, in ignorance and goodwill, I brought some of the younger ones to be cured. I can think of no more evocative image to convey the atmosphere of this place than the painting by Hieronymus Bosch, in which the magician, after the manner of a dentist extracting a live nerve, is represented as the deliverer of insanity. All the trumpery and quackery of our scientific practitioners came to apotheosis in the person of the suave sadist who operated this clinic with the full concurrence and connivance of the law. He was a ringer for Caligari, except that he was minus the dunce cap. Pretending that he understood the secret regulations of the glands, invested with the power of a medieval monarch, oblivious of the pain he inflicted, ignorant of everything but his medical knowledge, he went to work on the human organism, like a plumber sets to work on the underground drain pipes. In addition to the poisons he threw into the patient's system, he had recourse to his fists or his knees, as the case might be. Anything justified a reaction. If the victim were lethargic, he shouted at him, slapped him in the face, pinched his arm, cuffed him, kicked him. If, on the contrary, the victim were too energetic, he employed the same methods, only with redoubled zest. The feelings of his subject were of no importance to him. Whatever reaction he succeeded in obtaining was merely a demonstration or manifestation of the laws regulating the operation of the internal glands of secretion. The purpose of his treatment was to render the subject fit for society. But no matter how fast he worked, no matter whether he was successful or not successful, society was turning out more and more misfits. Some of them were so marvelously maladapted that when, in order to get the proverbial reaction, he slapped them vigorously on the cheek, they responded with an uppercut or a kick in the balls. It's true, most of his subjects were exactly what he described them to be, incipient criminals. The whole continent was on the slide, is still on the slide, and not only the glands need regulating, but the ball bearings, the armature, the skeletal structure, the cerebrum, the cerebellum, the coccyx, the larynx, the pancreas, the liver, the upper intestine, and the lower intestine, the heart, the kidneys, the testicles, the womb, the fallopian tubes, the whole goddamned works. The whole country is lawless, violent, explosive, demoniacal. It's in the air, in the climate, in the ultra-grandiose landscape, in the stone forests that are lying horizontal, in the torrential rivers that bite through the rocky canyons, in the supra-normal distances, the supernal arid wastes, the overlush crops, the monstrous fruits, the mixture of quixotic bloods, the fatras of cults, sects, beliefs, the opposition of laws and languages, the contradictoriness of temperaments, principles, needs, requirements. The continent is full of buried violence, of the bones of antediluvian monsters, and of lost races of man, of mysteries which are wrapped in doom. The atmosphere is at times so electrical that the soul is summoned out of its body and runs amok. Like the rain, everything comes in bucketsful, or not at all. The whole continent is a huge volcano whose crater is temporarily concealed by a moving panorama which is partly dream, partly fear, partly despair. From Alaska to Yucatan, it's the same story. Nature dominates. Nature wins out. Everywhere the same fundamental urge to slay, to ravage, to plunder. Outwardly, they seem like a fine, upstanding people. Healthy, optimistic, courageous. Inwardly, they are filled with worms, a tiny spark, and they blow up. Often it happens, as in Russia, that a man came in with a chip on his shoulder. He woke up that way, as if struck by a monsoon. 9 times out of 10, he was a good fellow, a fellow whom everyone liked. But when the rage came on, nothing could stop him. He was like a horse with the blind staggers, and the best thing you could do for him was to shoot him on the spot. It always happens that way with peaceable people. One day they run amok. In America, they're constantly running amok. What they need is an outlet for their energy, for their bloodlust. Europe is bled regularly by war. America is pacifistic and cannibalistic. Outwardly, it seems to be a beautiful honeycomb with all the drones crawling over each other in a frenzy of work. Inwardly, it's a slaughterhouse, each man killing off his neighbor and sucking the juice from his bones. Superficially, it looks like a bold, masculine world. Actually, it's a whorehouse run by women, with the native sons acting as pimps and the bloody foreigners selling their flesh. Nobody knows what it is to sit on his ass and be content. That happens only in the films, where everything is faked, even the fires of hell. The whole continent is sound asleep, and in that sleep, a grand nightmare is taking place.